you really have nothing better to do with your life than listen to me talk to behaviour experts about dogs, then this is your kind of show. Sit yourself down, eardrums at the ready, we're going in. Hello everyone, welcome to Just Shaying. This week my special guests are Denise O'Moore and Annie Phoenix, two guests for the price of one. So a little look at their bios. Annie Phoenix, professional dog trainer, BA in English, award-winning...
Stop laughing.
award-winning journalist. I'm going to say that again. BA in English, award-winning journalist, but never once offered to proofread for me. Began her career as a behaviour consultant and trainer for a dog rescue group. Fostered more than 400 dogs. Wrote for Dogster magazine. Author of Midnight Dog Walker's book, which is nominated for the Maxwell Award, and also authored the book Positive Training for Aggressive and Reactive Dogs, which is out later this year, I believe. It goes on. Certified Canine Behaviorist, CPDTKA, Fear-Free Certified Professional, Graduate of Schutzhund Dog Academy, CGC Evaluator, whatever that means, I haven't got a clue, member of Pet Professional Guild, National Association of Canine Scent Work, and Fear-Free Certified Professional. Annie Phoenix, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
I'm great. I'm very happy to be here.
Excellent. We're going to go straight to Denise's bio, and then we're going to come back to you both. Denise O'Moore, behaviour consultant, chair of Association of Into Dogs, which is a founding organisation of ICANN, the International Companion Animal Network, and signatory organisation of the UK Dog Behaviour and Training Charter. Co-owner of Puppy Power Training and Behaviour, affiliate of the ISCP, full member of the DWA, professional member of the PPGBI. Did I ever mention that I dislike acronyms? Trainer... trainer and puppy raiser for Irish Dogs for the Disabled. That sounds fantastic. Holds certificates in assistance dog training, canine bereavement counselling, canine arthritis management, illustrator and managing director of Mighty Dog Graphics. Her illustrations have appeared everywhere throughout the industry, including on that rather excellent book named Dog Training and Behaviour, A Guide for Everyone by, I forget who that's by, but by Shea Kelly. Hi, Denise. Thanks for joining us. And how are you?
I'm absolutely wonderful. And thank you for having us here today.
Excellent. So already we're cooking on gas, because the first week on this podcast, it was just me on my own. Second week, it was me and Claire Barton. And now we're up to three people. So you've already thrown my system way out.
Six people next week.
I don't think we're going to go there. We're going to go back to two next week, I think. It's already too much for my senses to cope with. Annie Phoenix, you're in Colorado. Is that right?
I was in Colorado. We lived there for almost a decade, but we moved to Utah, the neighboring state, which, 5 years ago.
Which to me seems not far away, but it's probably miles and miles and miles, because Colorado, this is educational program as well. Colorado is actually 10% bigger than the UK.
Is it really?
Bonkers. Yeah, but it's only about 5 million people, and we've got 65 million people crammed into this little space. That's why I'm stressed. So, Annie, you are 4,500 miles from Denise in Ireland. How did you two hook up together and become this tag team?
I harassed her to come on and do an interview with me when Midnight Dog Walkers came out, and we just kind of clicked. We've been friends ever since.
She was the first interview that I did. She was doing, I think back in the day where we would type in, there weren't any visuals. We would type in, and that was the live interview. And I almost missed it, because back then Facebook had an other chapter, other box, inbox and messenger. And I didn't see him for even after the book came out. So like a month later, I'm like, what is this? And hers was the first interview request. And we did become fast friends after that. We've been friends ever since. That was 2016.
Denise, you put a lot on your bio, but what you didn't put on your bio is the massive amount of Facebook groups you actually are involved with and help support and all that sort of stuff. Do you even know how many groups that you're an admin on?
I ran out of fingers. I ran out of fingers counting them.
How?
With all loads, that's on, loads and loads and loads.
With all that's on your bio and all the groups you're involved with, including Canine Enrichment, which is the group that I do, how do you ever find the time? Because here, where I am, there's only 24 hours in a day. How many hours do you have in Ireland?
I don't know how to answer that one.
You just seem to be everywhere.
Yeah, she's an admin on the Mendike Dog Walker. She's the only admin besides me.
Yeah, I'm like the Matrix, you know. Clearly, I don't exist in real life. I'm just in the Matrix. There you go.
I think a lot of people probably don't realize how much you support other groups other than your own interests, the amount of different groups that you're there supporting and getting involved with.
I try to stay behind the scenes on a lot of things and just I love seeing people succeed.
And of course,
I just love seeing everybody live out their dream. That's so important to me.
You know absolutely everybody. Because I share with everyone else. Just as soon as someone says something in the industry or contacts me, it's always Denise that I contact and I say, who is this person? And I'll get a full rundown of everything they've ever done and who they are. I can always rely on Denise to know.
She's the secret glue of the positive canine industry world, both in several countries, really internationally. And I don't, like both of you, I had the pleasure of interviewing for my second book that's coming out next September. And the book wouldn't have happened, I don't think, if Denise wasn't encouraging me, because I was not going to sign the contract. It was like, this is too much work. Denise is like, and she held my feet to the fire. Like, I'm done writing. No, you're not. Get back in there.
So yeah. What we're going to go to is part of the show, which I call Expert in the Room. And you've both got your particular interests.
Have you got
interests.
Any experts here?
Yeah.
Have we got?
Well, yeah. Both,
we have
you've
experts,
both,
have we?
You've both, well, we'll see. you've both got your particular interests and expertise in different areas. So I've come up with a few different things that I'd like to ask you. Mainly the point of this part of the show is really to get that information out there and to see what we can do to help people that haven't got that knowledge. But it's I was interested to see that you said you was a canine bereavement counselling certified trainer. That is the most difficult time for anybody who has dogs, and the time we must have all been in this situation. The times that you see people post to people you've known for years, and they're posting about their dog passing away, and as well as feeling great empathy for them, you also have a twinge in your heart knowing that one day it's going to be you making that post, and it's I can't even talk thinking about it.
I know, but
just a point I'm getting across is how difficult that is. So what advice can you give to people to get them through those dark weeks?
Well, it was something I always wanted to study, for the simple reason that, as you know, I work with dogs of the disabled. I have been with them for maybe 12 years right now. Can I just have a moment to read something? On their calendar, they have a photo of all their puppies, but they also have a little piece from one of their clients. This is about Dalton. He was the first dog I worked with dogs of the disabled. And this is going somewhere. I will explain to you in a moment why I was so determined to have a counselling and support and bereavement background. Because I've been doing this since 2005, so 17 years. All the puppies I've had over the years are going to be dying off one after the other, after the other, after the other, which I didn't think of at the time. And it's heartbreaking. But it's even more heartbreaking for the clients who had them. So I'm just going to read this. This struck a chord with me. It says, Barrow was born 25 weeks and as a result had a diagnosis of cerebral palsy, making walking very difficult. Since being matched with Dalton, When he was 2 years old, he took his first walk around the park, attached to the harness and handle to hold on to, as we watched with tears in our eyes, as we never thought this was going to be possible. Over the years, Barra and Dalton became the best of friends, and trips to the park, trick-or-treating and supermarkets all became possible with Dalton by his side. Holidays in France every year by boat were also possible without having to use Barra's special needs buggy or wheelchair. Unfortunately, Barra died at the age of 8, and the last photo shows Dalton in the hospital saying goodbye to a special friend. Without Dogs for Disabled, Barra's life would have been very different. Now, thankfully, this is a podcast and I can't show you the photo, but you can imagine. And what I had in my head was, this is where the child has died. And they kept the dog because Dalton was part of their family. But how many people lose their dogs and don't know what to do, don't know they're allowed to grieve? You know, there's so many levels of grief. There's disenfranchised grief, where you feel it's wrong to grieve. And you're afraid to grieve because everybody says, oh, it was only a dog. There's so many forms of grief. There's the full out grief where you are just shut down. You don't know what to do. And there's kind of this other, like, I know back in 2018 was a huge turning point for me in my life. Everything just came on top of me at once. Everything just hit me. I had, my partner had to get a quadruple bypass out of the blue. The moment he was home a day from the hospital when my mother just suddenly died, totally out unexpected, and my dad had dementia. So suddenly I was cast into the role of being his carer. And it was like, I'm trying to grieve my mom. I am in shock at my partner, and I have this anticipatory grief of my dad, because he's going to die. And everything comes together. It becomes too much. And for some strange reason, that was the time I chose to study canine bereavement, because I needed something else to focus on to help me get through things. And I just felt at that point, I'm kind of living it right now with humans. And to me, dogs are just as important to me as my dogs are just as important to me as all the humans I know. So that's why I kind of had to do this. And we've set up in the Association Into Dogs, we have a pet bereavement support group that, once the website is up, for anybody who is going through or knows their dog is going to pass away soon through an illness, or anybody who has suddenly lost a dog, whatever, we are there to help. So please do get in touch, because we just need to normalize grieving animals. It's as simple as that. You've been through it with Echo and Radar, Annie.
I was going to say, I wish I had known that existed. Echo passed away. Well, they both did in 2019. I had all of the stages of grief, and including anticipatory, because she had had brain cancer. But she would get better. Like, she couldn't walk for a couple of weeks, and I was not going to put her down. I'll just carry her out as long as she needs. I mean, I don't want her to suffer, but her mind was still very active, and she was my heart and soul dog. And she would get worse and get better, and I would call my husband just screaming from the vet, "Today's the day, today's the day." And then they would save her, and I wanted them to save her. $20,000 later, it was worth it. But I had that anticipatory grief, and so I thought I was going to handle it when she did pass, because she had been so sick. And I did for a while, and then I wasn't okay. I mean,
that's the thing. I mean, even with my father, like, I had that anticipatory grief, but I was struggling because I also had the grief of the sudden loss of my mother at the same time. And it was, I functioned, the morning he passed away, I functioned like a robot. I sat there for 2 hours waiting for 9 o'clock so that I could make all the phone calls. By lunchtime, I had the funeral organized. I had everything organized, because I just refused to let myself kind of deal with it. I just needed to get through this, kind of march on, get through it, be strong for everybody else. And I think being strong for everybody else might have been my big mistake. Because then you're being strong for everybody else can sometimes give an indicator that you're okay with what happened when you're not. So if anybody does need to talk, you know, just reach out, because there's so many out there that can help.
Especially hard with behavioral euthanasia. I mean, we're really going down the rabbit hole, but that is when the dog is physically healthy and it's beyond the point that any of us can help the dog. I have a chapter of that in the book and called it, It's the Hardest Decision. And there's that canine Facebook group, Losing Lulu, where they discuss it after it's happened. They just added a recent one because they don't want to get into the discussion of whether this person should put the dog down, because that's so emotional and so private, really. But they started a second group that I don't remember the name of, where that's where you can discuss that process. Like, I still have the dog and he just, you know, bit the kid down the street really hard in the face and I have to make some decisions. It's not that simple.
That's all right. I think the thing for me that stands out in everything that you said, Denise, is when you said about things going back to normal and feeling like it should be all right. And I think the first couple of weeks, probably you get quite a lot of sympathy and empathy and the initial grief. But then for everyone else, life goes back to normal. Of course it does. But for the person who's grieving, because that's, for me, always sticks in my mind that's the difficult time when everyone else has moved on and they think you should be fine. And really, you know, it's going to be a very long time
fine. That was very, very hard for me because I felt I had to be strong for everybody. I was putting on a front.
Yeah.
And I was getting through because I didn't get a chance to grieve. Well, my first dog, Pixie, when Pixie passed away, there was this disenfranchised grief, because at the time, like, we're looking at 20 years ago when it wasn't okay to be upset about a dog dying. And I was being told I was being overdramatic.
Yeah. And the other thing you said that stuck out was that, you know, you don't really know whether you're allowed to grieve or you feel guilty for grieving because people think it's only a dog and that sort of thing. And I would just say to that, the thing that comes to mind to me is it doesn't matter whether it's a dog, a cat, a person, whatever, the grief is about the relationship and that bond between two sentient beings. The species got absolutely nothing to do with it. And it's going to be a very difficult time.
It's a study of one. I mean, nobody can say, I know what you're feeling. No, you don't know what I'm feeling because you're not me.
So, Denise, your other, just one of your many other things that you do is a puppy raiser. And that just sounds absolutely brilliant. You just got to say what you do and people probably smile. What you're doing is you're raising puppies until they go on to do assistance dogs for Irish Dogs for the Disabled. Is that right?
We take them on at about 8 to 12 weeks. We do the puppy walking voluntarily because it is just so much fun. When I started with guide dogs, I was looking for a pet dog and I thought about going to a rescue and thought, well, we could get a dog and have a good 10 years with us where we have the joy of a lovely dog, or we could take on a puppy from the guide dogs and, you know, give a family independence. And, you know, 17 years later, how many families have we given that independence to by constantly looking after these puppies? Absolutely. And it's very hard to give them up.
So that must be really hard. I've always thought that about the guide dogs. Whenever I thought about it, I thought, oh, I'd run away with them.
Yeah. Well,
but the joy comes from what you're giving, doesn't it?
Well, it doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, the day they go into the van that you say goodbye, you kind of think, I don't care what's wrong with you. I want my dog back. and I am going to say it. Like, you really do. It's like, I don't care what's wrong with you. I want that dog back. But you heard the story I read about Barra. Dalton is still living with the family, and you know, it's heartbreaking when you see the good the dogs do. And what I love about the Dogs for Disabled is that they're puppies. They are puppies, and they get to be treated as puppies. All the training is done through play. Play and enrichment.
Denise, I've not asked you the question yet, even. Listen, you've obviously raised, no, it's not a difficult one. You've obviously raised lots of brilliant pups because that's their job, is to be brilliant. So what is your top tip for people raising a puppy?
Choose your battles.
It's your motto.
Choose your battles. Your pup does something, grabs a tea towel off the counter, don't chase him. 50 years time, who's going to care what he did off the counter? I'm always big on choose your battles, because to me, the most important thing about raising these dogs is building a bond and trust. I am quite happy to let them run off the tea towel, and then reward them for coming back and dropping it for a treat, because they are learning to come back and drop, not running off.
So another way of saying it could be, don't stress at the little things, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm with you.
Yep. And it's so important to involve your dog in things you do. Like if I'm kind of cooking and making stuff on the counter and the two of them are circling me like furry barracudas, I play a game with them. I have a dish of like chopped vegetables, tiny bits of carrot or frozen peas. And I say, wow, where's your mat? And the first one to get to the mat gets his treat. And then a few minutes later, I'll say, where's your bed? The first one to get to the bed gets another treat. So they're actually learning their places. So they never have a need to like be begging or climbing on the counter. This is a fun game. Yeah. If I'm doing washing and they're kind of curious about the washing machine or the tumble dryer, I'll throw their toys in just before it's finished. And then when I open, I say, where's your toy? And they learn to take stuff out, because that's stuff they're going to have to learn as assistance dogs anyway. And it keeps them occupied mentally. And it's fun. It's great fun.
Yeah, it sounds quite a bit like one of the things I sort of always advise in enrichment, really, is in involving them in your daily activities. Yeah. And them being part of family life and that sort of thing. So, Annie Phoenix, or Expert Annie, I've written on my notes here.
Oh, you're Emperor Shay, aren't you, tonight?
No one's got any idea what you're talking about nowadays, unless they happen to read that Facebook post.
Annie will fill you in, don't worry.
We're not going there. Annie Phoenix, the things I've picked out for you to answer expert or to give advice on your expert areas is, the thing that really stuck out for me is that you've fostered over 400 dogs, which...
Yeah, 2 decades.
How long have you been doing that?
I think I started in the early 1990s, which seems like an awful long time ago.
Still seems like a lot of dogs to get through. So what I really want to ask you is your advice for other people who are not necessarily fostering dogs, but they might be, but when they've got a new dog in their home that's not used to the home, not used to the person, what's your best advice around that to help people?
I would say to slow down. We have so much we put so much expectations on our dogs. Like I just, back pre-COVID, somebody would get a puppy in neighborhoods or an adopt a sheltered adult dog, and everyone would come over, or they'd bring the dog over to the neighbor's house, and everybody wants to hug the dog and comfort the dog, because especially if it's maybe a sad case, you know, we're here to save you and we're going to help you. And the dog just has so much coming at it. And who knows, if you got from the shelter, what that dog has been through. I like what Andrew Hale says, that when he meets dogs or people, he presumes there has been some trauma. And eventually in life, we all have trauma of some kind, even if we have the best life. So I would presume that just taking a puppy away from the mother is traumatic. You know, we don't think it is, but it is. They've lost, and their siblings, they've lost their everything that they know about their entire existence. And they're taken too young, or they're taken too old, and they miss that socialization period. It's so important. So for me, I would say, let the dog be a dog. Don't start micromanaging it, telling it no, 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 no. I ask clients to don't command or cue their dog for a week when I first start working with them. It doesn't mean they tear up your house. You know, it doesn't mean they bite your children. it just, we talk to them so much and tell them no, instead of what we want them to do. And I would say do a week of, or start from the beginning with canine enrichment. I mean, that's critical. To get them, that it fosters trust, it keeps their brains engaged. Don't take them to Home Depot and the grocery store and put them in the car and go. I mean, eventually you need to start doing that stuff, but let the dog decompress. And it's like a foreign, they're living in a foreign country now. And I think they just need more time of doing, just being a dog and not stressing it.
I think people forget that as well. I mean, we have these fear periods. We have these, I think it's one of the applied Stephen Lindsay's book, where 7.5 weeks is the prime time to remove them from their parents. And, you know, it's not the same for all dogs. You know, that's just kind of a generic type of timeline that people work from. And then some people think they can't remove them from 12 weeks. And then people get confused about socialization only having a window up to 16 weeks. You know, there's so much confusion and misinformation out there. It's just unbelievable at this stage.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ideas around it. And I know for a while, at least, a lot of breeders were making it a longer period before the new guardian took the puppy. I think the worry of that is thought to be that they become more socially, although they're getting more experience, they're also becoming more socially competitive with each other, and they learn to be more competitive. I think that was one of the worries around it.
It's 5.5 weeks from a old school veterinarian, not the non-veterinarians in general, because they have very hard lives, and I love veterinarians, but this guy should have known better. Took him from the mother of Northern Idaho. And I don't know why. And I never talked to him. I was only talking to his wife. And I like herding dogs, and they're half cattle dog, half border collie. And 5.5 weeks, I knew the damage that could have already happened.
I'll tell you a story. My first dog as an adult, so I was very young, I was in my 20s. I went to buy a fish, and I came back with a German Shepherd.
You do, because it's easy to mistake those.
I am that bonkers. I stayed married as well. Well done, mate. And I lived in a flat with no garden, an upstairs flat. What was my point? Oh, my point was that I had no idea what I was doing. I wasn't into dog training at that time. That's the dog I got into dog training with. She lived for 14 years, spent her life with me, and was a brilliant dog. But absolutely a wrong thing to do. And it turns out I live just outside London in England. It turns out this dog had been bred in Wales and was basically had been puppy farmed, taken to this pet shop, which also sold fish. As you do, dogs and fish in the same place.
I know, it's so easy to mix up a German Shepherd with a goldfish. And they look so alike.
Luckily for me, she turned out to be brilliant and was the easiest dog I've ever house trained. But that was her, that wasn't me. She was just brilliant from the start. But I was very lucky. But even then, she was only 6 weeks old, and she'd already come from Wales and been in this pet shop for however many days. And, you know, things have changed a lot since then, thank God. Mm. But not a very good start, and certainly not how they should be. And then it left the littermate as well, because there was two of them. That would have then been left on her own, too young as well, without the mother, without littermates. Very sterile environment.
I came home with two. I went to get one. The red heeler, who looked like a little white because I've always had shepherds, and my husband's, and the blue heeler, his brother, was left. And my husband he knew me.
Well, I want to ask you both, while you're both here together, is that you've both got a lot of experience online, I would have thought, with running, especially Denise, with running your trillion groups, and Annie with running the Midnight Dog Walkers, is it called?
Mm-hmm. The official. Midnight Dog Walkers.
The official Midnight Dog Walkers. That's what I should put on Canine Enrichment.
Yeah, exactly. There's a long story behind that. We will tell you at some point.
So what advice would you both give on responding to and coping with negative or derogatory comments? That I don't need to give examples, because anyone who uses Facebook or social media knows the sort of thing we're talking about, especially in groups.
I ignore them at this stage. Life's too short.
We approach this very differently, and I don't know which one's healthier, because I think Denise is kinder in her heart than I am, and I'm more bitter, but I'm older. I've been around longer, and I just hate trolls. I absolutely hate them. And so if somebody, my group is private, Midnight Dogwalkers is private on purpose. All your groups are public and public.
No, mine's private now.
Private now.
But it was public, right?
Yeah.
Because anyone can come in, and then you're fighting trolls instead of talking about what you want to talk. And I hate that. I hate wasting time. I hate trolls. And I feel like I can sniff them out. I can see them coming. They just say a little sarcastic one here, one there. And so my response is, which Denise has been trying to work on me, is block, 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 block. Like if I saw on your page, K9 Enrichment, and somebody was being rude, I block that person and they're not on my group. I don't respond to them. I just, you're a jerk. I don't want you in my life. That's my own personal boundary. I just hate.
Well, for so long, I've tried to.
I try to reach out and say, like, what's your problem? What do you want to talk about? But if they don't want to talk, then I just go away.
Yeah, the problem is, I think I'm quite good at giving to the point answers, giving factual answers, not getting carried away with the stuff they're going on about. The problem is when it becomes somebody else jumps in, and then somebody else jumps in, and then people, you've got the, what's it called, a straw man argument, where people are misrepresenting what you said on purpose just to give their argument a better to look better and make it easier to argue. And then you're arguing about what you actually even said in the first place, because they're arguing about something you didn't even say.
And then you wonder, why are we actually doing this? And that's when you turn off comments and just go, to hell with it. The problem, game over.
The problem becomes when it's just so time consuming, especially when you're in such a massive group of people. It might be easier if you're just having a one-to-one with somebody. Yeah. But I was surprised recently, because I'm a Buddhist. I'm not a great Buddhist, but I try. And you always sort of try to reach out and be reasonable and have empathy and you know, all that sort of stuff. And I was surprised recently. It was only reasonably recently when I was listening to Kathy Murphy on something, and she basically just says, I just block people if they start. And it's just like, and I just, what? I thought you knew about psychology and brains and stuff. Yeah. So she gave me more encouragement to block people, block people. Because it used to take me a long time to do it.
Yeah. Well, Annie does just go block. I kind of tend to look and see what's behind the comment. Is there anything behind the comment? Is there something we should be looking at? And I just take that extra few minutes to check. And if it's not, then I just block.
See, there are, to me, I'm very aware that there are people that are just trolling. That's all they do.
Yeah.
Especially dog groups. And I don't give, you make one, not one mistake, but if you're rude on my page, not to me, to anybody, you just want to argue. This is my place is not to do that.
Which is why we have that rule of, we brought in a rule just to say no derogatory comments. And, you know, that's it, sort of thing. Just to try and stop it. It's obviously still very difficult.
Mind you, we have nearly, 500,000 on the page.
Yeah, I have 1,500.
We have a few more in K9 Enrichment.
There's still plenty of people to argue in whatever size group, really.
A group of three, you'd still have an argument.
Denise, I've only blocked two people in this whole year of COVID from Midnight Dogwalkers. And, you know, I was watching them.
Wow.
Red nasty.
That's so good. I'll give you a cookie for that.
Well, here's what happened with these two. I don't know them. Okay. And they had been really quiet in the group. They weren't friends or anything, but they just left these nasty little pokey things that were kind of, you could read it either way. Was that rude or was that not rude? It seemed just a little sarcastic. And I started noticing them. Sometimes I'll put them on a hold where they can't respond if something or stop the comments. But those two caught my eye, and one by one, a couple of months apart, they just said something really nasty. And so I kicked them out of the group. Both of those people contacted me personally on my Facebook page and said, why did you do that? You're a terrible person.
I've been there.
I think we all have.
I said, this is not the group for you. You've just proven this by everything you're yelling.
I don't see why people get so absorbed in groups that they have to attack them, attack at men.
I've had people who have been, there's caused so much problem that they've been blocked from the group, they've been blocked from me personally for making comments, and then they go to my blog and use the contact form to carry on. They've just got to carry on and carry on, and then they'll,
I've had then that they on Mighty
bad
Dog.
Reviews and yep. all sorts.
I've had that on Mighty Dog a lot as well, where people don't like an infographic that has been put out. Thing is, I didn't write it. Somebody actually commissioned me to do that, but they don't attack the person whose name is on it. They attack me. I was like, oh, go away.
I just don't have
time. I will listen to what you have to say. If you are valid, if you have a valid excuse for ripping into me, fine. I listen. And, if I've spelled something wrong, or generally, if I've just spelled something wrong, which is happens a lot, I'll change it. But if you're just kind of doing it for the laugh or just to troll, go to the person who owns the poster, not me.
So, right.
It's just not fair.
Getting down to the bones of the advice, Annie is going to block them, and Denise is going to listen to them and then block them.
I don't give a chance.
We're moving on. And so everybody who comes on the show is getting the same question, really, is that what is your thoughts on enrichment, and what do you do to ensure that your own dogs have an enriched life?
I was thinking about this, and I do have your book, and I love the Canine Enrichment, and I know you have the other one, and I want to get that one too. And I read it, and it's a thin book, but it's powerful. It's like every sentence is there for a reason. And I think canine enrichment, like when you guys started that group, I'm like, this is brilliant. Why hasn't this been here this whole time? It's kind of like one of those things so vital and important. And it takes away from the argument of what quadrant are you using, and you're using positive. It's just like that's over here. We're not talking about that. And it highlights what the dogs need so much. And we're also, in addition to micromanaging our dogs, we don't engage their brains enough. I've always had herding dogs. That's just my personal favorite. So they need to be engaged, or you're going to have a problem pretty quickly. They'll come up with their own stuff, and usually it's fairly insane. So I think canine enrichment is, it should be on top of every dog owner's mind. Like before you ever go get a dog, think about what that dog's going to be doing 8 to 10 hours a day for 10 or 12 years. And it's our responsibility, because they're captive in our yards, in our houses. It's not a walk. It's way more than a walk. And even a walk is a lot of times for the human, and they're yanking their dog along and not letting the dog sniff when the dog is leading through its nose. So canine enrichment to me is one of the core principles of keeping a dog happy and resolving problems or stopping problems before they begin. A bored dog, a frustrated dog, is going to cause problems for its owner. It's going to create its own solutions. It's not sitting around thinking, this human is terrible, what can I do to get back at him, which we might do. They're just bored, and they have needs. They have enrichment needs. That should be like, what is it, the five things, of five welfare?
Five Fs.
Freedoms.
Five freedoms. Enrichment should, I think it might be in there, but not with that word. But that should be.
I think Stacey Todd, in her book, How to Make Your Dog Happy, the WAGMA book, she has about 10 or more freedoms.
Yeah, it's five is not enough. Tip of the
five eye. Is not enough. Yeah.
And I love what you said, Annie, because one of the bit you started with about it not, or it's not about arguments about positive reinforcement and all that, because one of the main things I had in mind when I was starting out on that route and starting the group and wanting people to be thinking in other ways was that it's always about training, or it's always about how you train, or it's about who's the best. Or I'd come from Dog Trick Geeks, was my previous group, and it all became about who was best and how you train this. And it was that side of it. And this gives people something where they can interact with a dog, they can provide for the dog, but it's not a competition. It's not about how good you are. You can't, it's never about how good the dog is at enrichment. That's not the idea of enrichment. So it gives another, I just think it gives another focus, because at one point, going back a few years, when you consider doing anything with a dog, it was always thought of in terms of training. That seemed almost all there was, if you know what I mean.
Yep, obedience, obedience, obedience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So did you have any thoughts on that, Denise?
Yeah, I've removed the word socialization out of my vocabulary and I've replaced it with enrichment, because for the simple reason that for years now, it's, I don't agree with this regimental training. I never done obedience with dogs. I've never even taught a dog to heel, because I work with dogs that are going to go on to do assistance work.
Mm.
I did find a conflict when I was working with pet dog owners, because a lot of them say, oh, the dog's doing this, this, and this. And I'm looking, going, oh my goodness, you could get him to do that, that, and that. It's like, oh, it's a pet dog. Okay, reel it back in. So I was getting very conflicted, because I'm seeing what dogs can do versus what people want them to do. And I didn't like that. So with my guys, it's, if you're going to learn anything, you're going to learn it through what I call edutainment. You're going to be educated through entertainment. Because I know I learn better when I'm enjoying what I'm learning. You know, I'd sit through class in school and I'd fall asleep if the teacher was boring, or I'd be wide-eyed, bushy tail going, oh my God, give me more, give me more.
Give I never had any of those days.
That was very rare for me in school as well. it was mainly like, oh God, I'm going to sleep. So, yeah. So I kind of think back, everybody learns a different way. Some people learn visually, some people learn verbally, some people, you know, there's different ways of learning. So I look at the dog in front of me and see what ways he actually learning, or he, she, whichever, is learning the best. And then I just work with that. I go with that. I mean, I have two dogs at the moment. Both of them learn differently. Both of them have very different needs. So everything is done differently, but it's all done through what I call edutainment. It has to be fun. They're not going to learn otherwise. That's simple.
Is this a word you've just made up, or is it something I've missed out on?
I made it up about 25 years or 23 years ago in Germany at a film conference I was at.
Oh, you've kind of turned it around, I think, because from what I often say to people, because people are always saying to me what enrichment should they do for puppies. And I'm always of the mind, I don't think of it in that way. I don't think of it as being enrichment for puppies, because, and maybe I should, but because I think they're learning about the world, and I'm not worried about how many Kongs or silly little puzzles they've had, or, you know, they're exploring, they're learning. And I think you've just come up with a new word for it instead of what I'm trying to say.
Well, I know with Neville at the moment, he's my bench buddy. He is my bench buddy. Every park we go through, if there's a bench, he has to sit on it, and I'll sit beside him. Because he'll sit there staring at me until I sit beside him. Then he'll lean in against me and he'll kind of observe everything that's going on. The mouth will be open, the mouth will close, the nose will go, the eyes will go, the ears will move. It's just fascinating to watch everything he's taking in. And when he feels comfortable, he will stop leaning against me.
Aww.
Then he's ready to get off the bench.
Denise, I just figured something out about you. Whole circle moment. So most dog trainers will say, pet dog trainers, we're called in adolescence. Like there was a perfect puppy and now the dog, their mind is literally in a different stage and changing. Mm-hmm. It's like teenagers. So most of us are like, oh, how old is he? Is he 24 months? No, don't, I can't help you. It's too late. Just live through it and he'll get better in another 6 months. But you love working with adolescents.
I do.
And here's why you get along with dog trainers. Because you were dealing with adolescent brains.
It's so exciting. It's so exciting, especially with the assistance dogs, because they are being constantly trained to kind of do task work.
Mm.
So their brains are constantly moving.
That's very unusual.
But you're doing a lot of work with them, aren't you? It's
24/7.
So I'm just really, when I look back at my own dogs, I've never really noticed a big adolescence phase in that, them becoming less responsive, but I'm always doing a lot with them, so it might not be as noticeable.
Well, I love the 5 to 6 month phase where they suddenly discover they can reach the counter with their paws. That is just, to me, it's like, yes, you've hit that phase.
I didn't let my dogs know they could do that. Be quiet.
No, I actually let them for the simple reason that I'm going to put that on cue. Because if they go to somebody in a wheelchair who can't reach a counter, they're going to have to be able to reach the counter to remove something for them.
You might need that.
So I'm going to choose my battles. Yeah. And I'm going to put it on cue. And as Karen Pryor says in our top 10 of Don't Shoot the Dog, put it on cue and don't use the cue. Simple. Put it on cue, don't use the cue. Now, what I do is I quite often use cue randomly to keep it fresh in the dog's mind. So when they go for big dog training, as I call it, it's there and they're not afraid to do it. I had one that was an Olympic gold medalist for jumping. So I put the jumping on cue to turn on the light for me. Because that was actually Dalton, the one I spoke about earlier. He was like a polar bear. He was huge. And he just wanted to jump and cuddle. So I transfer that cue to the light switch so he could turn on the light switch for me. And he was really happy because he'd turn on the light switch and then he'd sit down and he'd get his reward.
So we're going to part of the show which I like to call What's Your Beef? So what in the industry, only one thing each, we'll let you have one each. I've got a double beef this week. What in the industry really gets your goat, you're not happy with, you want to set the record straight on?
For me, it is since day one, and I did it too, because that was all that existed in the late 1980s, is using equipment or training protocols that causes pain or fear. Once you understand canine language, it's painful to watch what these dogs and people, trainers that use that, post their videos online very proudly of a dog cowering and hitting the floor. And I feel like it's abuse and it's allowed in training circles, and I will always speak out against it when I see it. I think it's enormously cruel and unnecessary,
and very, very difficult to educate people on, or to sway people, or to change minds. I've gone to so many lengths over the years to explain, write blogs, and even in my book, the blue one on training and behavior. Explaining exactly why those things don't work, and the possible fallouts and all the rest of it. And people will, you can go to all those lengths. I'm on my third degree. I'm doing a master's now. People can know all that. They can know you've got this education. It matters for absolutely nothing. What matters to them at that moment is their belief. And they'll just say, well, they can be good tools if you use them properly. Mm-hmm.
And they don't say that about the clicker. Nobody, I mean, you could confuse a dog and cause it to frustration.
Oh, God, yeah.
Not harm. It's not meant to harm, to stop behavior. It's to encourage behavior.
With me, it's off-leash dogs.
Yeah.
It's friendly. No, it's bloody not. No, it's friendly. My dog's not. I have a big yellow flash on Jeffrey's leash that says, hi, be kind to me, I'm arthritic. And people see it at a distance and think he's a guide dog, because over here we use yellow flashes on the leads for guide dogs, along with the yellow jackets. And they've been very respectful. And since I got that flash on the lead, it's been a game changer for poor Jeffrey. With Neville, he is cued to lie down. He's cued to lie at my foot if a dog comes by, because he's a golden. He's going to bounce at them, and I don't want that. I have him cued to kind of lie at my feet. And on the count of three, we walk on. But some people can't walk by without extending their flexi leads and letting the dog come up and say hello. And I'm thinking, that's exactly what I don't want happening. So people need to be more respectful of other people's dogs. If a dog's on leash, walk on by. Simple.
Especially with service dogs. Oh, well, all dogs.
Oh, there is a guide dog down my way, and some days the gentleman walks out with his wife, so he has his arm hooked in hers. She guides him because they're giving the dog an actual walk. The dog has a little halter on and he walks along. He's elderly, but he is a guide dog, and everybody in the area knows that. And still, when his harness is not on, people still let their dogs run up and interfere. And it just does my head in.
I'll never forget a beautiful lab that I worked with in Durango, highly trained diabetic dog for a medical doctor who had type 1 diabetes. And she called me after it was attacked. I mean, that dog is allowing that human to help other humans every single day of her life. Beautifully trained dog as well. He was attacked walking downtown Durango where cars are going by an off-leash dog. So he became fearful after that. Like, it interfered with his ability.
Mm. What you said, Annie, about your one with the aversive equipment, and you mentioned that they don't say the same about clickers or something like that towards the end. Mm. And it just sparked a memory in my mind. I was trying to think who it was who said it, but I think it was Jean Donaldson in A Culture Clash, where she says something about people who use these aversive tools are often they're against using food. They're often concerned about the result of using food in, you know, it'll spoil their dog or make their dog fat, or, you know, they have these concerns, but they seem not to have the concern of what choking or shocking or is going to do to their dog. And that just seems, when I read that, it just seemed really crazy, doesn't it?
It's a crazy fallout.
Yeah. The relationship is damaged.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole thing about dogs is the bond, decompression, the bonding, the trust. Enrichment. Yep. I mean, because it's your group, Shay, but we all get that a lot with the enrichment group. Is that will make my dog fat? It's all about food. No, it's not.
Yeah, I mean,
there's different types of enrichment.
My most common post in the group over 4 or 5 years it's been going, most common post must be that it doesn't take any extra food, it doesn't take any extra calories to use food for enriching purposes. You can just use the food that you're feeding in more interesting and engaging ways, and all dogs have got to eat, so you might as well. That's not to say that there isn't lots of other forms of enrichment that don't include food. But this is going to take us, you nearly asked a question there, but this is going to take us to the part of the show, which is called Ask the Host. So you get to get your own back and ask me a question of anything you like.
How many different types of enrichment do you want people to know about?
Oh, gosh.
That don't include food. Because I was just thinking about all the different types of enrichment, just... that moment when we were talking about it. So I'm just going to throw it at you.
You couldn't really say a number, really. I think for a lot of people, it's easy to just start doing one thing and then you do that repeatedly. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's always an against, isn't there? The problem with saying that is that people finish a puzzle or a, you know, whatever it is, and then they think, oh, the dog's finished that, it's no good anymore. So it is still good. You can do it again, you can do it over and over again, you can do it every day if you like. But what I'm getting to is that I wouldn't just stick to the same one thing every day. I'd be using lots of different types of enrichment to use their brain in different ways and different engagements. And, you know, and it's not all about giving the dog a Kong toy. I mean, I'm a real foodie. I do loads of food enrichment. My dogs eat all their food through enriching ways, even if it's just throwing it on the floor. But life has got a lot more to offer. And for a lot of dogs, that's about the bond between the two of you. And if food's always getting in the way, that can take the tarnish off that a little bit, because they're always looking for the food, even when you're just giving them a stroke or something. And I've nearly been there with Mr. B, who's such a foodie. But life's about a lot more. It's, you know, getting out and about and exploring the forests and being able to run through rivers. And there's, you just see the things. You look at Mr. B and think the only thing he's ever going to be interested in is food. The way he is around food.
Well, you have a great video. You have great videos of him. When you sneeze, he takes out a tissue.
But that is about food. That is about food, because he's getting food for those tricks.
Okay, well, with Neville.
But what you've got to do.
He loves to sit in a bench and just absorb. Exactly. And
So if you. What I'm saying is, if you saw Mr. B like that, you'd think that's all he's interested in, but it's absolutely not. There's nothing he loves more than meeting other dogs. He's so friendly, loves other dogs. He loves rivers, jumping in streams, going through the forest. There's just so many things. He goes to, I work for a small charity doing something outside of the dog industry, and he goes to work with me and sits in the office, and he's just... going back to what you said, really involving them in your life and all the different aspects of your life. There's so many different things that are important to the dog, building relationships and
just being just, together.
You can't put it down to one thing. So there should be a mix in that way. If you think of a wild animal, they're using all their different senses to do lots of different things, to find mates, to find food, to, you know, they're using all their senses and skills and brain power to do that. And they spend a lot of their time doing that. And that's why we need enrichment to fill that behavior deficit, if you like. But if there was the one thing that does stand out to me, which is I'm always going to come back to, is olfactory enrichment. So anything scent-based, to me, that is the dog's world. That's the dog's umwelt, you might say. Almost everything they do, I think, to some degree, has got a connection with olfaction.
And that is so difficult with assistance dogs.
Yes, exactly.
When you think about it, which is why, for me, I am determined to just work with the puppies, because I want to give them the best start in life, that they get all of that. They learn to do it on cue.
It's quite well known, you know, certainly in the human world, that mental well-being and good mental health affects how you feel about other things, affects your decisions, affects your ability to learn and remember. And it's exactly the same for dogs, I would argue. And so fulfilling their needs and giving them a better mental balance and well-being is going to pay dividends in whatever you do with them, training.
Absolutely.
Not necessarily training, but how they live their daily, how optimistic they are, how pessimistic they are. So, Annie Phoenix, did you have a question?
I do. As usual, I'm going to break the rules.
I'll try and give a shorter answer.
I'm going to break the rules.
Just mute her.
Block me. Just block me. I have two questions. That's how I'm breaking the rules. One is a short one, and let me ask both. And the first one is, what does Mr. B stand for? Because I don't know.
Barney.
Simply Barney, and I'll tell you the story, is that I used to help out at Nosy Barker, a dog training centre in Harlow, especially when I started my studies many years ago. You have to do so many hours work experience, and so that's how I got friendly with them. And that's Kim Kay and Ryan Kay run Nosy Barker.
Oh, they're so amazing.
And Ryan, really, really, really nice man. Probably, I shouldn't say this, but probably that... probably the only man that I know that I'd leave my dog with, and know he'd have a better time than he would with me, because he just loves what he's doing, and he loves the fun aspect of it. And you know, and Barney's not your being told what to do sort of dog. He'd be backing off as soon as anyone raised their voice at him. He wouldn't like that sort of thing. So he absolutely loves Ryan. Anyway, Ryan started calling him Mr. B just out of the blue, and it just stuck. So it's stuck all these years. Came from nowhere, really.
I love it.
Yeah.
My second question is, like Denise, you have done a huge amount in the dog industry. You have two books out. You started Canine Enrichment Group. Beyond that, you have a master's or finishing a master's?
I'm doing my master's now. I'm doing the research part of it now. So I'll finish it this year.
And plans for a probably a doctorate, which is why we call him
Emperor Shay.
Yeah. No plans for a doctorate at this moment.
Not yet.
Trip the bridge and be Emperor Ming.
It takes 6 years part time, and I don't know if I've got 6 years left.
Yes. Question is, Shay, is about you personally. So we've talked about canine enrichment. What do you do for your enrichment, for human enrichment, that doesn't involve dogs, like a hobby, or how do you enrich your life? That's beyond.
He writes books.
Are you telling me there's something that doesn't involve dogs?
I'm curious if there is. Something.
Well, I've got my.
I could not answer that. That's a tough one.
I've got my Buddhist meditation. I've been very much into Buddhism for many years, which has helped me a long way. Years ago, I suffered with depression, like many people have. And there's two things that have really helped me. And the first one was finding Buddhism. And it's not some sort of weird religion, you know, for me. I don't believe in reincarnation or anything like that. There's lots of different types of Buddhism. And Buddhism really for me is it's your own path. It's, you know, you're not looking at external gods, you're looking inwards at yourself and so mindfulness and that side of it.
It's an inner reflection, and it's a peaceful mind. And it's a beautiful religion.
Well, it's a bit like enrichment, really. That's my example. Coming back to that again, it doesn't matter how much time you spend on the cushion, which means meditating, if you don't take that out into the world and practice that. And one of the things of Buddhism as well is influences my life is that Buddhist teachings should never be charged for. They're supposed to be free. So even Buddhist retreats, you do pay, but it's voluntarily. You know, if you didn't have any money, you wouldn't be stopped from going on a Buddhist retreat. And so I try to bring that into the dog world, and that's why I write blogs and do things. I don't want it all to be about the money, and I try and avoid that. So I'm a behaviorist, but it's still not my main income. And I don't really want it to be. I like it to be my passion and my joy. And anyway, I've gone off the track now. I know it'd be a long answer. And the other thing that has really made a difference is studying itself. Going back to university, started university 8 years ago, I took a year out before I started my master's. So I did a foundation degree, then I did a BSc, and now I'm doing a master's in animal behavior and training. And what I found is my brain need to focus. So I've always got to have a goal or a project or a something to have my mind on. And so studying really has been my passion and a bit of, I say Buddhism like I'm some sort of real cool, chilled out guy, which I'm really not. But that's my aim is to be mindful and be like that. I don't always achieve it. There's a joke in Buddhism that or a saying that mindfulness is easy. It's remembering how to do it that's difficult. we're going to the part of the show which is the randomizer, and that's the lucky dip of questions, basically. So I have this randomizer.
That's not a good thing.
Very technical.
Yeah, that's going to be scary.
It cost me ever such a lot of money, this randomizer. So your first question, we won't have both people answering the same question unless you particularly want to. So we'll go with Annie first. What advice would you give? We had this one last week. That randomizer is broken. We'll ask it anyway. There's loads of questions in there. What advice would you give a previous boss?
Previous boss?
You don't want her to answer this publicly. You really don't. Just bleep her.
If it was on Facebook, she'd just block them.
I did tell my husband I was working for a while in a commercial kitchen, and the chef was like 32. I'm 56. And I was sitting around one day, and she was my boss, okay? I worked for her, but I've been an entrepreneur for so long. I said to my husband one day, you know, I guess she's kind of sort of my boss, like the only boss I really have, but she's not really my boss. And he just died laughing. He's like, she's your boss. I'm like, she's 32. There's no way. She's not my boss. I'm choosing to be there to help her. So I have a problem with authority, so people might notice. And I, that's one reason I'm my own boss. So I haven't had a boss in 30 years. So maybe I have to say it to myself. I would say, don't be so fast to judge people and their intentions, because I'm, or what they're saying, because I was just thinking about Shay asking questions. There's a difference.
You would have blocked him.
Well, see, that's
I was just going to say, you're contradicting yourself.
Because it depends on what I think you're asking. If I think my perspective, you're being a troll, but if you really want to know, I'm happy to answer. But my prejudice is troll, troll, troll. And so I would say to myself as a boss, don't assume the person is being a jackass. Let them prove that they are.
If this is a good one, if dogs could speak, what breed would be the rudest?
Oh,
probably my lab retriever cross.
A what?
My lab retriever cross, poor Jeffy. He would probably be the rudest. He'd be like, feed me, feed me, feed me. And I'd be like trying to talk to him, going, yeah, but he's no, I don't care. Like, talk to the paw.
What is your biggest failure and what did you learn from it? Oh, that's quite deep, isn't it?
How much time?
Who put that in there?
Good grief.
But 5 seconds.
I have a 100,000 page memoir written, and I would like to submit that as my answer. I have made plenty of mistakes, plenty of mistakes. I think probably it is underestimating or making up my mind very quickly about people. And I'm usually right. Well, I think I'm a pretty good judge of character, but I do think that I'm harsh. And so that's a mistake. I'm too harsh with people, and I'm not harsh with dogs at all. Like, dogs are genius saints.
But I would say, in mitigation, at least you know you're harsh. Or, you know, it's people who don't know they're harsh that have got a problem. So what plans do you both have for the future?
I am booked out till September. I am involved with 3 new books this year that I cannot talk about other than nannies. But yeah, I am up to my eyeballs in artwork at the moment, and it's a real struggle because my computer screen died the other week. I had no internet for like 3 weeks at the start of the year, and now my screen died and I have a new one. Anyway, long story short, when I get through all of that, I am going to take a few weeks off to kind of just spend time with Jeffy. Next year, I am hoping to have a new website and products and whatnot, and you know, we'll see how it goes. See how it goes.
Cool.
I've been asked a few times to write books, and I don't like writing books, so I'll probably just draw pictures. So maybe it'll be a comic book or a graphic novel on dog training. Who knows?
A coloring book.
I've done that already. I've been there. I've done that. So,
how about you, Annie? You got any plans for the future?
I do, that I was not expected. So I kind of pulled myself out of the dog training industry about right after, well, a year or two after the Midnight Dog Walkers came out. It was just extreme burnout, bad attitude, some might have said. Seems impossible. I was just tired. I was so tired. We were moving and we had a renter that I had to go back and fix now. So I wasn't really settled in Utah as a dog trainer, and I never really have trained here. And I just thought I was taking a break. And then I got into keto cooking and, you know, non-dog stuff and enjoying it, you know, all the stuff that burns us all out. I had all of that. And I wasn't that happy with how I was helping. I was always worked with troubled dogs, reactive dogs mostly, but every kind of trouble. And I really wasn't getting that much satisfaction from the main tool. There were lots and lots of tools, but counter conditioning and desensitizing, it's like, it's, we could talk about that all day. That's the big tool that we were using, and the other stuff too, definitely other stuff. But I just didn't feel very satisfied with that. And it didn't seem like the clients did as well. Some they worked great with, but it didn't work for great for every single dog. So when my editor called me last August and it said, could you do the second edition of Midnight Dog Walkers? Called me out of the blue. I had no intention of writing a second canine book. And I'm like, no, that sounds like an awful lot of work. I don't think I really want to do that. I'm having a great time. I'm semi-retired. And I literally almost didn't sign the contract. And Denise did help me decide to do that. Thank goodness. Because it was a cathartic process for me, which I don't expect from a non-fiction book, really. It's just like, I'm going to talk about canine behavior issues. How cathartic could that be? It's kind of a chore, really. I'm writing it for the dog owner because there's not enough good trainers, force-free trainers. And I'd rather them read a book and help themselves than to hire somebody who's going to hurt their dog. But I decided, which I thought was quite brilliant in the end, to interview experts because I'm trained as a journalist. I've been a journalist since I was 15. And I really do like interesting people who are helping animals.
Award-winning journalist.
Award-winning, don't forget that. And so I picked 21 people. It was very hard to choose. Just because somebody's in the book does not mean they didn't deserve a spot. But I was looking for specific things, which is, what is new since I removed myself from the industry? What new ways are people helping dogs? And it just blew my mind, actually. And why it was cathartic is I asked almost all of these experts, are you optimistic or pessimistic about the dog training industry? Because it's very easy to be pessimistic with the tools that are used and the way animals are harmed in the name of training, et cetera, and breeding problems. Every one of them said they were optimistic. And every one of them, as Denise says, has their head down and they're working hard for dogs and they're not out there on the boards fighting and screaming and attacking other trainers and making a name for themselves only. And that was so surprising, and to see what people are doing, like every chapter and the compassion that these people had for animals, just, it blew me away. And so by the end of the writing process, I was then optimistic. Not by nature, obviously, I'm not an optimistic kind of person. And I feel very happy and excited for dogs for the first time in a very long time because of what these experts are doing. They are including canine enrichment. I mean, that wasn't there when I was actively training. At least we weren't talking about it as much. So I became enthusiastic. I renewed some certifications. I got a new certification, one I'm very excited about, Family Dog Mediator through Kim Brophy's course. Totally game changer. Andrew Hale's talks, what does he call it? Beyond the Operant is a new, whole new discussion, and I loved it. In fact, when I found his channel, I stopped writing for a month. I only had 6 months because I'm like, what is he talking about? What are they talking about, Beyond the Operant? And I watched all the videos, and I interviewed a lot of the people that he's had on there as well. So now I renewed my business card. I renewed my licenses, got new licenses, and I'm going to actually tiptoe my way back into working with individual dog owners, at least for a year, and see, because I feel like I have new tools.
But I had the same thing really when I saw Andrew Hale's Beyond the Operant. I haven't watched as many as you, but watched a few, because I'm, you know, I've just spent 8 years studying at Operant, and I was like, where are you going with my work? What are you doing? So it's very it's a very interesting subject, and it gets your mind thinking in other ways, if nothing else. It's so that is an area that I'm really interested in as well, and you know, I'm getting very interested in emotions, and it's all, that's part of what he's doing. So it's of big interest to me as well. Denise O'Moore, how can people find out more?
I'm a very private person, to be honest.
You don't want them to know anymore.
No, they can all go away. No, you can find me on Mighty Dog Graphics on Facebook and the Association of Into Dogs or intodogs.org. My Mighty Dogs website has been down for like a year or two, and due to private issues, I just haven't bothered getting it sorted. I have too much else on personally, but it will be up and running next year. And yeah, you can just find me on Facebook. Simple. Find me on Facebook. And I live on Facebook. I am Facebook.
And we didn't even get into dogs, and we'll have to do that another day about, because I'm fascinated with all the organizations that are around.
That's a big subject on its own. Yeah, we have the bereavement. Pet bereavement group, and we have the social inclusion team.
And Annie Phoenix, how do we find out more about you?
A dog training website. It's phoenixdogs.com. It's phenixdogs.com, because that's my last name. No O in Phoenix. That is renewed and up. And I invite people to come join us on the Midnight Dog Walkers Club. It is a private group. I'm sure no trolls are listening because they're not invited and they won't get in.
And if they do, they won't be there long.
Won't be there long. You will be burnt. But it's a very interesting group because it's a smaller group and it's owners and trainers. And the one rule is just don't be rude. You know, don't be, don't be a troll because you won't last. And so I feel like it's a safe place as much as it's ever going to be safe in on a social, like we don't get into the arguments that you see on so many pages. It just doesn't happen.
We don't have the time or the energy or we couldn't care less.
And when is your book out?
Life's too short.
September. It was supposed to come out in July, but.
She wrote too much.
They moved it to September, the end of September, I think the 27th, because I wrote too much. That's what they had to solve me, because they left me alone at least for that part. And I think it's 100,000 words.
And so just like that, it's the end of the show. Thanks so much to my guests. I'm so used to saying guest. It's hard to say guests.
Yeah. Who would have thought that would be a difficult 45 word? Minutes.
So thank you so much to my guests. I'm now going to spend the next 2 days trying to edit this down to an hour. Annie Phoenix and Denise O'Moore. Thanks to all my listeners. Thanks to all my listeners. Tune in next time when I'll be talking to another great dog behavior expert. Goodbye. Thank you all so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, click the follow button and share with others. If you didn't enjoy the show, write a strongly worded letter. Not to me, obviously. I'm busy.